Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
My guest today has a soft spot for flies. According to Jonathan Balcom, without flies, we simply could not survive. And for this reason alone, they warrant respect and consideration. Jonathan Balcom is a biologist with a PhD in ethology, the study of animal behavior. He is the author of four popular science books on the inner lives of animals. He has served as the department chair for animal studies with the Humane Society University and director of animal science with the Humane Society Institute for Science and Policy. Jonathan Balcom's latest book combines science and storytelling that unveils the remarkable world of flies as never seen before. He says that flies would thrive without us, but if they disappeared, our planet would collapse into chaos. His new book is Superfly, The Unexpected Lives of the World's Most Successful Insects. Jonathan Balcom, welcome.
Hi, Nancy.
Your last book, What a Fish Knows, happened to be the title of your last book, and it was a New York Times bestseller. But now and people can kind of see, okay, fish, they're interesting. But why are you writing about flies?
Well, to be cheeky, because they're interesting too. There's so much to learn about flies, so much to know. We've learned a lot, but of course, one of the paradoxes of science is that the more you learn, the more questions you have and the more ignorant you feel. But suffice to say that this is an extremely successful group of organisms, one of the largest subgroups of the most far and away successful group of organisms on Earth, and that is insects, which make up 80% of all animal species. And flies themselves number 160,000 known species, and perhaps as many as five times that number that are yet to be discovered and described. And we're in an era where, unfortunately, our activities are making it so that there are fewer and fewer places for insects to live safely, and their numbers have been declining. So I'm here to be their advocate and to hopefully build a better future for them, as well as us.
Well, when I was reading your book, I found myself thinking, gosh, I didn't know that. And also realizing how ignorant I am just of the structure of a fly. We see flies all the time, but I don't really examine them that closely. And shortly after I started reading your book, some friends and I were outdoors and she swatted a fly away. I said, no, wait, I want to look at that fly. And it was about 2 seconds after we sat down, a fly appeared. So you're right, they are around us all the time, but maybe that's why we just take them for granted.
Yeah, they're ubiquitous, you know, they're everywhere, and it's just natural for us to take them for granted. I know the feeling, I've done that before too. It depends on your mood or what your project is, and generally flies that we encounter are, well, often they're a bit of a nuisance. Say they may be a mosquito after our blood, or it could be a housefly bouncing in the window. But yes, if you stop to look at them up close, they are not only interesting, but also very beautiful, or at least some of them are. Beautiful colors, iridescent blues and greens, and the symmetry. I had the fortune to, or the occasion to, look at several freshly anesthetized fruit flies during my research for this book. They were tipped onto a dissecting scope at a genetics lab in Georgia. And the beauty, they were like jewels, just they shone, and they're so clean looking and shiny and with different structures and symmetry, really lovely to regard.
Now, you just use an adjective that I don't think people would use. When you describe the fly as clean, Jonathan.
Can I explain what I mean by that?
Please do.
They look like they'd been polished. I've seen video of blue bottle flies. You know, the irony, of course, is these animals go after rotting flesh and waste products. And we might be thankful to them for that, because they keep the earth a lot cleaner. But we don't associate that with beauty and cleanliness. So, but they look, these ones look like they've been carefully buffed by somebody with some polish, and they really truly were maybe gleaming is a better word than than clean?
Well, I have, when I have looked at a fly closely, seen them rub their legs together. And they live in a dirty world for the most part. And so you say that they're cleaning themselves when they rub their legs together to clean them.
Yeah, they have taste buds on their feet, as well as their proboscis, their mouth parts. They can taste it with their feet. So as soon as they land on something, they're getting an early read of the chemistry and the appeal or lack of appeal that it has for them. And so it's a little bit like cleansing their palate when they're rubbing their feet together, as many of us will have noticed that they do.
Well, the other day I noticed a little lizard had, I think it, my sidewalk, he'd crawled onto the sidewalk and he was dead. His body looked perfect. It didn't see any damage. And so I didn't toss him away right away. I thought, I'm going to see what happens to this little body. And it wasn't long before it was covered in insects. And I mean covered. And it was a small lizard. There weren't flies. They seemed to be ants. So you do include other insects besides flies in your book.
Yes, partly because flies interact with them so much as well. And certainly ants are included in that. I also do describe a lizard that I found on a pathway in Florida when I was living at the time after a rain. And this lizard, unlike the one you found, had a gaping wound in the side and had been dead for some time and was sort of beginning to deliquesce in the heat. And it was covered with flies. And something I often do, I gently or carefully dragged this little lizard off the path into the bushes where insects like flies and ants could have at it in a more safer circumstance. And what surprised me, Nancy, was that after I dragged this lizard off the path, I kind of expected some flies to be still gathered at the wet spot on the path from where I dragged it. And of course, on the lizard now in the bushes to the side, they were there, but they were also along the straight line that the lizard had traveled when I dragged it by the tail. They were able to detect the presence of these chemicals of decay, even though you couldn't see them. And I just found it an uncanny illustration of the acute sense of smell that these insects have.
Well, you know, I think when people read your book, they will have a different feeling about, say, they encounter a little lizard instead of thinking, oh, that's disgusting. They'll think, oh, how interesting and how grateful I am to this insect population that's taking care of this on my behalf as a human being.
It's one of the great benefits of these creatures that they are attracted, as from our perspective, that they are attracted to decay and waste products, because it means the world is a lot less foul and pestilential place thanks to their cleanup efforts.
Well, you use the word mutualism in your chapter that's entitled Botanist, and you have a quote by Charles Curran, and he says, insects are our worst enemies, but this fact should not be proclaimed from the housetops without this, at the same time, crying much louder of the benefits they give us. Flowers, fruits, vegetables, clothes, food, pure air, beauty. And we, particularly in recent years, have become so aware of taking care of the bee population because of their role in pollination. But I don't think people know that flies, these unwanted, unwelcome insects, are also pollinators.
That's right. Flies are ranked second only to bees as pollinators. They are very important for getting on flowers and transferring their pollen from one flower to another, which of course is how reproduction works for flowering plants, at least for most of them. 90% of the quarter million flowering plants in the world are pollinated by insects. And as you go further north or south in the world away from the equator, you get to colder zones or higher altitude zones, flies take over as the primary pollinator crew. So they're really star pollinators, and their value as pollinators for food plants for humans is estimated, the insects' value as a whole is estimated at over $500 billion per year. And yet flies are unsung heroes in that regard. I remember going to the Montreal Insectarium, a very nice facility, and they had an exhibit in the front in the lobby of star pollinators, and there were 41 insects pictured there. and not a single one was a fly. Apparently, no one there has ever had chocolate, because that's one of the plants. The cocoa plant is only pollinated, as far as we know, by a tiny little fly midge.
Well, when you mention that Montreal insectarium, you use a phrase "fly neglect," because you were saying you've got this museum. I'm going to call it a museum in Montreal, but they neglected flies in that museum dedicated to insects.
Yeah, flies need a little PR work on their side.
In fact, I don't have any plans to go to Montreal, but I wish I had known about this museum when I did go there some years ago. I would have gone to that museum, this Montreal Insectarium. I think it's a place you could learn a lot, a place devoted to them. And then you mentioned an article about bees, but include a photograph of a fly.
That's right. There are many flies that that benefit by, and actually some other insects as well, that benefit by mimicking bees. Bees, of course, many species having stingers, and their would-be predators learn that sometimes the hard way, and so they learn to avoid bees. So by looking like a bee, a fly can avoid attack by a bird that otherwise would be happy to eat a fly. It's so good is their imitation, so well do they mimic bees that they're often mistaken by us for flies. Even by entomology students, they've been mistaken for bees when they're actually flies. And there's several brands of honey over the years that have printed nice pictures on their jars that are pictures of drone flies and not honeybees. And no honey will ever issue from a drone fly.
Well, you mentioned the book Lord of the Flies, and the cover picture, you'd think, well, there's a fly on the cover, but it was not. And it seems like the people who are composing, designing the cover would know to put a fly on the cover. How did that happen?
Yeah, once again, falling for the mimicry. In this case, it was clearly a stinging insect, a wasp or a bee. The difference is here, of course, aside from the stinger, which is one very important difference, no fly has a stinger. Was the fact that the bee has four wings and flies only have two wings. And the insect on the cover of this book clearly had four wings. So the thing is, most people aren't going to notice that anyway. They're going to pick up the book and think it's a fly. But if you look closely, there is a difference, and it's an important difference.
My guest is Jonathan Balcom. He is a New York Times bestseller, and his latest book is Superfly: The Unexpected Lives of the World's Most Successful Insects. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, scientist Jonathan Balcom, whose latest book is Superfly. You mentioned that there are over 100 crops that are pollinated by flies, and one of them you mentioned in passing a moment ago. I happen to be a fan of chocolate, and so I all the more appreciated these insects who help us out in helping the chocolate be produced, because you tell us in your book that cacao, the plant, cannot fertilize itself. How does that work?
Yeah, many plants have evolved to rely on insects to move their pollen around. You know, there's some flowers that can benefit from the wind and rain and perhaps other mechanisms for moving pollen around. But the flies are because they're mobile. Flying insects are excellent pollinators. You know, so are bats. The fact that they can fly as well. One of the funnest things to research and learn about while I was researching this book was the high level of specificity that some flowers, with which some flowers have co-evolved with flies and other insects as pollinators. So there's flowers that of course use smells that are unpleasant to us because they mimic the smell of rotten flesh or waste products, animal poop, and that attracts the flies which swarm all over it. And then there's some flowers in the orchid group in particular that actually imprison flies for a while. They close shut and the fly is trapped in there, and they offer tasty, alluring smells and tastes, and often not much food. But they don't want to kill the fly. There are some plants that will eat insects, as you know, but these ones only imprison them temporarily, long enough to get the polonium stamped onto their back or something like that. This is a pollen-carrying structure. And sometimes it's quite a violent ride for the fly in there, maybe a bit like going into a scary ride at a fair. But they eventually let the fly go. And the whole idea, of course, is that fly then, hopefully, from the plant's perspective, flies off to another plant of the same species and then lands on there. And the pollen gets transferred. And because different species will stamp it with polonia in different locations on the fly, it's actually okay if the fly goes to a different species, because it's only that particular part of the body of the fly that will carry the pollen to that particular part of the flower in the next species. So several species can be pollinated during one foraging foray by one fly.
My guest is Jonathan Balcom, and his latest book is Superfly: The Unexpected Lives of the World's Most Successful Insects. And you mentioned the flowers, and in your book, you include a photograph of the flower of the cacao tree, and you refer to it as being a complicated flower. And so I studied that little tiny flower to figure out, okay, how is that little tiny flower pollinated by an insect?
Yeah, it's a lovely little flower. It's not very showy, despite that it's kept being on a tree. A lot of tree flowers are quite small. And it has... I don't actually fully know it myself, but a guy named somebody Young, I forget his first name, but he spent years studying the system and describes the flowers in quite high detail. And I think the fly has to almost squeeze between a gap to get in there. And it's a very narrow gap, suitable only to this particular type of fly.
Well, you have this chapter about how important flies are, insects are to pollination, producing the food that we eat. But now, how do they reproduce themselves? You have a chapter that you call Lovers. And at one point you say, okay, so they have sex and then maybe they watch TV. Now, Jonathan, are you pulling our leg there?
A little bit, but not entirely. I admit I will sometimes stretch things for a little bit of humor and levity for the reader. But consider that flies, studies with fruit flies, which is the most studied insect and probably the most studied animal on the planet because of our understanding of genetics based on studies of that species. But studies of flies, of fruit flies, find that they... tweak my memory, Nancy. I'm sorry. I know we're taping this and it's been a long day with 16 interviews and I just lost the thread briefly.
Well, we were talking about fly sex and all a courtship includes, and it sounds like you could be listing a human courtship. You say there's singing, foreplay, kissing, gift giving, and on occasion watching television.
Yes, thank you for reminding me. Yeah, what I was going to get to was this remarkable attention span that these flies have. The careful studies show that they actually can get tired and bored of the same stimulus, and it's a visual stimulus. But if it changes, their activity in their brain bursts up again. And so after they've had sex together, perhaps fruit flies, if they're in a house, which they often are, there might be a TV nearby, and that would probably draw their attention because TVs have moving images on them. So I couldn't resist the opportunity to make the comparison there. But certainly foreplay and gift giving and cannibalism and complex genitalia and serenades and even giant sperm is another phenomenon of some fruit flies who've evolved this strategy of making extremely long sperm cells. It's the tail, and it's like a big piece of spaghetti. Perhaps you've seen the picture in the book, and it's thought to be adaptive by acting as a shield against any subsequent male, that their sperm won't be able to penetrate this mesh and get in and fertilize the female.
Well, I mentioned, that part of the courtship includes singing. And how does an insect sing, Jonathan?
With his wings, actually. These flies can buzz their wings, flap their wings at extremely high rates of over 1,000 beats per second in some of the smallest flies. And the sounds they make are quiet, but they're audible. I mean, we've all heard the whine of a mosquito. Those very rapidly moving wings create tones, and these flies will flap the wings at different speeds, different angles to create different tones. And they also use the wings to fan the female, to waft her perhaps with pheromones, which will hopefully get her into the mood and want to accept him. And so the wings, they're vital, of course, for flying, but they've been co-opted also for use in courtship. There's actually one fly species it's the only known flying animal that has asymmetrical wings. Obviously, having symmetrical wings is very important for efficient flight, but apparently courtship is more important to this fly than efficient flight, because these wings, by being asymmetrical, are thought to enhance the courtship act.
And you also say that this is something that is unknown anywhere else besides humans and songbirds, is they can adjust the volume of their singing.
Yes, it's been found that fruit flies, again, because they're just so well studied, will sing louder songs if the female is further away. So it seems to be they're aware that greater distance requires greater volume to be effective.
Well, now, you also include a quote by Aristotle, and I thought, oh, no, he got it wrong. Aristotle got it wrong. You say Aristotle described the sounds of flies as being, quote, like the opposite of meaningful speech. And Aristotle concluded mistakenly that flies have no voice and no language. And you beg to differ, don't you, Jonathan?
Well, they certainly do communicate in various ways, and certainly that courtship is part of where that manifests. And insects are actually, they seem to have minds, and that's an area of interest that has only recently been pursued by scientists. For much of our history, we just assumed they were nothing more than little machines who didn't have any feelings or any experiences. But there is now new evidence that insects may be sentient. Their brains are certainly differentiated into structures like mushroom bodies, which handle learning and memory. A central complex for spatial organization and organizing movement, and a protocerebrum, which connects brain regions and also collects sensory information. And studies on wasps, for instance, which are not flies, but they are insects, find that they have individual face recognitions. They recognize other colony members by their specific facial patterns. How do you find that out? Well, scientists took photographs of the wasps' faces and then digitally manipulated them. So an antenna was moved somewhere else on the face, for instance, or the eyes were reversed. And when these wasps were presented with these jumbled faces, they would not allow them back into the hive. They were aggressive towards them. So that's just one of the many little manipulations that scientists do. Tool use deserves mentioning. It's found in a number of species of insects. Observational learning, The honeybee's waggle dance is, of course, famous for symbolic communication of things like the distance, the quality, and the direction of a food source. And I mentioned attention span in flies. There's also rational decision making and transitive logic. So there seems to be a mind in a fly.
Well, I felt sympathy for poor little male fruit flies who get rejected by a female. And you say in your book that even the most ardent suitor faces possible rejection by a female fruit fly. And she makes it very clear. There's no doubt. What does a female fruit fly do to the poor male when she doesn't want him?
Well, sometimes she may kick him in the head with one of her hind legs. It's a pretty quite a clear indicator that she's not interested. And that may be because she's already mated and she has nothing really to gain. The male fly doesn't see it that way. Interestingly, rejected males are more likely to turn to alcohol in the case of fruit flies, which is relevant because the fruit that they go after is often rotting. And one of the byproducts of fermentation, of course, is alcohol. So alcohol very much appears in their environment. Another interesting relationship between fruit flies and alcohol is that flies will self-medicate. Female fruit flies will actually imbibe alcohol if they know they've been parasitized by a little wasp. And this the alcohol, in this case, may act as a toxin to repel or ward off or kill the parasite that's in their midst. This is an example of self-medication in an insect.
Well, there's an insect, love bugs, and when I was reading your book, I thought, well, they must have gotten their name for the long duration of copulation. You say love bugs, they were known to copulate for 56 hours?
Yeah, it's quite a marathon, quite impressive. And it's not the longest among insects. There are Styx insects that I think the record is something like several dozen days, let's say, anyway, days in a row. Part of that is the strategy of, if you're from the male perspective, if you're occupying the space that another male might want to get to, you are very effectively repelling other males. So staying attached to the female, and it's literally attached. These creatures have very complex genitalia that inflate and twist. Some flies have to twist into an 180 degree configuration for proper full locking of the genitals to happen. Which is why you may find, as I did once during a hike in Maryland, one fly perched on a vertical surface and the other fly attached to the rear end of the first fly, hanging upside down with their legs pointing outward. I was quite surprised to see that. And it was only years later that I read about this 180 degree rotation that has to happen for some species to successfully couple.
Yeah, but you do say that an active sex life is good for them. They live longer. They have an active sex life.
I guess being happy is adaptive. And there is evidence for pleasure in insects. Octopamine and dopamine, which are linked to pleasure in us, those biochemicals occur across a huge swath of animal life, including insects.
And I think that would surprise people. If these insects can experience pleasure, as you were just describing it, then they must also experience pain, and not everybody sees it that way.
Yeah, we don't generally look at insects as subjects of moral concern, but if science continues to show what it's been showing, then we may have to revise our relationship to them. It's certainly understandable that we should defend ourselves against an insect out for our blood, and it's certainly, I certainly do that as well. I sometimes give them a second chance, but there's a limit on what we should tolerate. Nevertheless, the fact is that there is growing evidence for the possibility of pain in insects, including chronic pain after, say, loss of a leg or another injury, based on a study done in Australia published just a couple of years ago. So it's going to be interesting to see how our moral landscape may change as we learn more about insects. When I went to this conference, I think I may have mentioned in November a couple of years ago, as part of the research for this book, there was a whole session on the ethics of insects.
My guest is Jonathan Balcom, and his newest book is The Unexpected Lives of the World's Most Successful Insects. And you have a chapter on genetics. And I think most of us do know that fruit flies are extensively studied. A lot of studies involve fruit flies, and we directly benefit. You tell us that fruit flies help discover that x-rays are not good for us. We were x-raying. I mean, when I was a kid, you'd go to buy a pair of shoes and you'd step under this thing so you could see how your feet fit in the shoes. You don't see that anymore. And fruit flies played a role in our discovering x-rays have drawbacks.
You know, actually, I have to tell you, Nancy, I don't remember that writing that particular part of my book, but I do remember a number of things about the whole genetics. Yeah, the fruit flies are the darlings of genetic research when it comes to animals that we study. Partly just because they're very convenient. Also, they do well in captivity. Their demands aren't high. They're easily and cheaply fed. Their generation span is very short. They can have 25 generations in a year, so you can cover a lot of evolutionary ground in a relatively short time. And there's well over 100,000 scientific papers that have been published so far on fruit flies, and many hundreds every week adding to that list. 7 Nobel Prizes have been awarded for research in which fruit flies were very important, including last year's 2020 prize for the development of the CRISPR gene editing technology, which was won by an American and a French woman. So they've definitely played a big role in our understanding the building blocks of life.
Yeah, often when I read articles about some new discovery about cancer, and it comes from research with fruit flies, this information that we learn about cancer that we can apply to humans. And you do tell us why scientists and researchers focus on this particular species, because focusing on one species means that they can share what they learn from their colleagues and they can build on that if they're all working and observing on the same species.
That's right. There's a huge reservoir of information now on fruit flies. And there are many, many species of fruit flies, which actually are technically vinegar flies, but we just call them fruit flies for short. And as you say, scientists benefit from being able to piggyback on the findings that others have come up with. You know, we've had their genome completely described for decades now, or at least a couple of decades, perhaps. And that adds to our ability to draw inferences and to make conclusions based on what we know of their genetic complement. When I was an undergraduate student in biology, I soon discovered that I wasn't very good at genetics. I was not particularly good at the quantitative sciences, but I owe my fascination with animal behavior, or my realization that I had such a fascination with them, to a genetics lab in which we would knock out flies with ether so that they were unconscious and then count the eye color as part of a genetic experiment. And I surreptitiously, instead of dumping them into the little bowl of oil, which was called the morgue, and to be their final resting place, I instead dumped mine onto the tabletop and kept an eye on them while they began to recover from the ether. And I was transfixed. It was just fascinating to see these tiny little specks of life with all their complexity start to twitch, and one wing would buzz and one of them would spin around on the tabletop, and eventually they stumbled to their feet. They looked like little drunkards in the street, and they eventually, you know, gained their wits enough to fly off into the cavernous room to whatever fate, who knows. But I realized then that I really wanted to study animal behavior.
Yeah, because the protocol was you do this experiment and then you kill these little insects. You didn't call it killing. You just put them in the oil in the morgue. But instead of setting them free, that was the protocol. They were supposed to be killed afterwards. And you said, no, I don't want to do that.
To this day, when I find an insect, be it a spider or a beetle or a fly trapped in my apartment, if it's not the middle of winter, I take them out. I have a container and a lid. It doesn't take me very long. You get better with practice. Out they go. And when I let them go, I feel like I'm liberating a little chunk of my soul. It just feels good to support life rather than take it.
Well, you mentioned going to the University of Georgia to consult with this researcher there named Kelly Dyer. And you posed the question to her, which I didn't think she answered you, Jonathan. You said, are flies sentient? And you remember she said, well, we respect them, but I didn't see her say, yes, I think they are, or no, I think they aren't. She said they respected them.
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, these scientists adore their subjects, but the nature of their research often involves killing them. And, you know, I noticed some conflicted feelings that some scientists had over this. And but I think, you know, they're always ultimately trying to protect the species. And it's one of the paradoxes of human enterprise and investigation that often we harm while learning about and ultimately hopefully protecting. You'll have to look hard to find a fly scientist who doesn't adore flies and doesn't think that we need to keep them alive and is not very concerned about the biodiversity loss that we're experiencing with some 50% of all insect life gone in terms of numbers gone in the last half century.
Well, you posed a question to an entomologist, Art Borkent. You asked him if he had any qualms about killing little animals. You referred to the little animals. And did he?
Yes, he did. He said I was only the second person to ask him if he had any mixed feelings on killing them. And he said, yes, he says it does. He's a very thoughtful guy. He was very helpful as I was researching this book. And he said, yes, I do feel sad for that. It troubles me that I to do the kind of research that I do, which is partly to document biodiversity and document species loss or new species, or really both of those, that it does give me mixed feelings. But he, like other entomologists, have very, very passionate feelings about the need for us to change our ways. We need to build more nature reserves. We need to stop, get off our habit of putting pesticides on everything. You know, in the last 30 years, we've spent billions of dollars to kill flies and other insects and mere pennies to preserve them. We need to get rid of lawns and replace them with natural gardens. We need to include invertebrates in our conservation efforts. And lastly, we need to eat lower on the food chain for biodiversity's sake. When you consider that 83% of global farmland is used for animal agriculture, that is either raising animals or raising plants to feed them, and yet that animal agriculture sector produces only 18% of the food calories we consume. So we definitely can make some changes in our own behavior to help flies and to help the planet and ultimately ensure our own survival in the future.
Well, I think young children would have you asked me if he had qualms about killing little animals. I think young children do. They have a curiosity. And yet, as they get older, we say, no, you're supposed to kill flies. You're supposed to kill these insects, and they're bad. And so I don't think we're born with these tendencies. I think we learn them as children.
I agree. You know, on the contrary, I agree with what you say. And on the contrary, we're born with a natural fascination and curiosity. Most kids are fascinated by insects, and they may squash a bug because they've seen adults do it and they've learned a lesson there, the wrong lesson, in my opinion. And I think we adults have a responsibility to nurture feelings of fascination and feelings of empathy towards other animals. I recently written a children's book that kind of taps into that, and I think we need more messages like that.
You've been given approximate age. You say by age 10, most children either love or hate insects. And those of us adults, if you make us aware of this, we'll catch ourselves, I think, Jonathan, before we teach children that insects are bad and should be killed. And if we become aware of it ourselves, maybe we'll encourage this natural curiosity about insects. In fact, I remember one time just being out in my yard reading on the grass, and some little ants came crawling by, and I found myself just fascinated by these little ants crawling along. And I thought, how nice it is just to stop and pay attention to these insects. And if we pay attention, we see that we owe them a lot of debt of gratitude. And you say that a growing number of humans consider an insect not a pest, but a fellow denizen of the planet. That was encouraging, Jonathan. I was happy to hear that.
Well, I hope it's true. You know, on the one hand, we have more and more people growing up in an urban setting with less contact with nature and And Richard Louv has talked about nature deficit disorder. It's an interesting concept where young people are kind of cut off from nature and alienated from it because of lack of exposure. On the flip side, there's so much to be interested by, and there are more people, certainly in my social circle, because I work in animal protection in addition to being an author of books. And so a lot of people I know out there are just love insects, and certainly celebrities are getting in on the act too. I mentioned a number of celebrities, you know, Morgan Freeman, who keeps bees, mm-hmm. and who's decried the use of Roundup and other pesticides that are disrupting, literally and metaphorically, that are disrupting animal life in all levels of the food chain. And because flies and insects are so vital as elements of the food chains, both as consumers and as food for others to consume, whatever befalls them is going to trickle down or up in the food chain. This is as Rachel Carson warned, you know, half a century ago.
Well, it was occurring to me too that when Michelle Obama was in the White House, she had a garden, invited children to this garden, and they surely must have learned about insects, those children who had the good fortune to spend time in this garden. Like you were saying, we seem to be more and more removed from these natural settings.
Time and again, it's the exposure to these creatures that's all that's needed. You just let kids see them and interact with them and see what they're like. And the fascination is natural. I think it has to be taught out of them. So we need just to make sure they have more face time, if you like, with these creatures.
Well, one of our California heroes who spent a lot of time outdoors in nature was John Muir. And he recognized this interdependence of our planet as an interactive whole, that we all, there's interdependence. And I'm hoping maybe that is becoming more widely accepted, this interdependence of all of us, plant and animal life.
Yeah, such an important concept. An analogy that I really like, and I recount this in the book, is by the Ehrlichs, Paul and Ann Ehrlich. They liken every individual species to like rivets on a jumbo jet, a big jet airplane. And if you've been on those jets, if you've seen them, there's just probably well over a million little metal rivets that have been used to staple or to attach the pieces to each other. And if you start popping rivets out at random, which is analogous to losing species, them going extinct, it's like popping rivets, and you can pop any number of rivets, maybe hundreds, maybe even thousands, but things are going to start to rattle, and eventually a piece is going to fall off. And you know, we know what that means for an aircraft. And it also is a similar outcome for the planet. The planet functions well because it's evolved huge diversity over time, and that creates complexity and stability. And we can only continue to take out species for so long. And unfortunately, our activities so far have been largely blind to this biodiversity. And now, finally, it's beginning to be talked about. And we have climate change and we have a pandemic. So we certainly have our challenges. And I just hope humanity realizes that we don't run the show. We're very vulnerable. We're part of the life here. We're not apart from the planet. We're part of the planet. And we need to be much more protective and caring and long-term vision instead of the short-term gain that we tend to think of with our economic systems.
Well, we do get concerned when we hear that an animal's going extinct and we take steps to preserve that animal, but we don't even know what insects, you mentioned that insects are fast disappearing. We don't even know what insects may have gone extinct because they don't even all have names yet.
That's right. It's sad to think that when you hear about the numbers of with the destruction of rainforests, for instance, one of the world's richest habitats in terms of biodiversity, and I forget how many football fields a day it is, but it's something like 6 football fields a day that we lose. You hear these very disturbing numbers, and such is the specificity with which little insects sometimes occupy the planet that if you take out a few football fields, the chances are you may have eliminated and made extinct any number of species of tiny insects that are only found in that small an area. It's called a novelty rate by scientists, by entomologists, when they sample in the tropics. And if you sample insects in the tropics, you're going to have a very high novelty rate, sometimes 95, even 100%. Every single insect in there was previously undescribed by science.
Well, we I think your book is going to make us more aware of this, what I'm going to label a problem. And also, maybe we're less likely to scoff at Eastern religions when they say, oh, no, don't step on that insect, brush aside. And we might have thought, oh, those Eastern religions, they're crazy. Maybe we won't. Maybe we'll get thinking they're crazy and thinking, oh, yeah, maybe we should be paying more attention to insects and preserving ourselves by preserving these insects.
I hope so.
Thank you so much for writing this book, Jonathan, and for the work that you do on behalf of animals and human beings. I'll remind people that the title of Jonathan Balcom's latest book, he is an author previously of the New York Times bestselling book, What a Fish Knows. And in his latest book, he has turned his attention to flies. Jane Goodall says this book is utterly fascinating. I think your readers will find that case, Jonathan. The title of his latest book is The Unexpected Lives of the World's Most Successful Insects. The title is Superfly. Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you, Nancy.
After a break, humorist Eric Miller will tell us about a special cat in his life. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Humorist and author Eric Miller, a.k.a. Etc. Guy, tells about losing a feline friend.
The name of the story is entitled Cat's Life Was a Great Ride. He went down swinging. I grew up a pet lover. I've owned cats, dogs, chickens, goats, and parakeets, critters with fur, feathers, teeth, beaks, horns, hooves, paws, and claws. Some of my animals I remember better than others. Radio, a sweet Labrador retriever named by my daughters, was one. I got Velcro in November 2005 at a kid's birthday party, a party favor, if you will. I doubt the kid actually had a birthday. It was a fabricated ploy to hand out kittens. A sucker for kittens, one feisty tomcat caught my eye. He stood up in his pen, meowed, and picked me. The little guy sported a white coat with black spots. I figured he'd make a perfect playmate for our puppy, Radio. The kitten was named after I brought him home. I sat cross-legged on the couch reading the newspaper when I felt claws tear into me. The kitten climbed onto my lap and peered beneath the sports pages. The youngster hadn't learned the art of claw retraction and stuck to me like Velcro. And so he was named. Velcro grew up in Radio's mouth, a living chew toy. The two ran, chased one another, and sparred. Radio never harmed Velcro, nor did Velcro scratch the dog. They were mates. Velcro socialized to puppy slobber and took on canine behavior. Velcro came whenever I called him, followed wherever I walked, and enjoyed boxing sessions. By day, he roamed the backyard hunting for voles, moles, and mice. The yard was his domain, his Serengeti, a place that required population control. He gifted me dead rodents, and I'd praise him. He hunted all night, but as he aged, he preferred hanging out with me. He greeted me after work, swatting my boots as I walked past. "Where have you been?" he'd scowl. The animal communicated through his eyes, gazing into mine, a strange telepathy as if saying, "I got skunked today. Feed me." but not dry food. I want chicken and ice cream. Then I'll sleep on your head. Velcro did not easily intimidate. He stood his ground like a sentry, stalwart, but indifferent. A buddy brought his three-year-old Labrador, Rainy, for a visit. Rainy is the consummate hunting dog, a fetcher, swimmer, well-trained and disciplined. But around Velcro, Rainy took a wide berth. On their first visit, Velcro swiped Rainy's hindquarters. The dog yelped and jumped higher than a tailgate. Over time, the two animals got along, each respecting the other. For the past year, a difficult period for me, Velcro was a trusted friend. Just after New Year's, I took Velcro for a rabies shot and physical exam. "How'd he do?" I asked the vet. "We wore welder's gloves. Your cat is fine, but my technician needs band-aids and counseling." I forgot to disclose that Velcro had a temper. But right around Valentine's Day, I noticed changes. Velcro's health appeared to wilt. He measured each step, nearly stumbling over leaves, and no longer jumped on my lap. He had neither thirst nor hunger, not even for ice cream. Velcro's litter box remained unused for several days. He stammered like a punched drunken fighter knocked onto the canvas. It was like Velcro had a cat stroke. I struggled with the decision to put Velcro down, hoping he'd recover, but each day his condition worsened. Velcro whimpered when I petted him and he struggled to walk. His eyes locked on mine as if to say, "I've had a great ride, but I'm done." I drove to the vet on a Sunday afternoon. The kids arrived for moral support. I coordinated paperwork with the vet, who then sedated Velcro. But before administering the final shot, the vet allowed us to spend private time with our friend. Velcro lay limp in my lap. We knew euthanasia was a humane act. My youngest daughter leaned into me. "When you get a pet, they're a guaranteed heartbreak years later, but we do it anyway." The vet returned to the waiting room and, after a brief pause, administered the last shot. In seconds, Velcro was gone. Velcro lived over 15 years, outliving our dog Radio by 5 years. My kids grew up with Velcro from kindergarten to college. Velcro's life covered more than half my kids' lives and a quarter of mine. Thanks for the memories, old friend, and thanks for picking me. We had a great ride. My name is Eric Miller.
I would also like to thank my first guest, best-selling author Jonathan Balcom. His latest book is Superfly: The Unexpected Lives of the World's Most Successful Insects.
Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.